Hey everyone, this is Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we delve deep into the gravity-based side of mountain biking. This week we're supported by We Are One Composites. We Are One are making amazing carbon wheels and bars in Kamloops in Canada. I've been on their wheels for 2 years now and I'm a big fan of what they're doing. I've just got a set of their Faction rims on my new bike and I've had the opportunity to take them out for a few rides now. They're a little bit lighter than the Agent rims that I had on my last bike, but given how tough those were, I've got no worries about these. They feel amazing, striking the balance between stiffness and compliance to give you a wheel that goes where you put it, but doesn't feel harsh and ping off everything in sight. If that sounds good to you, then you can check out their entire range over at wearonecomposites.com. And as a Downtime listener, they're kindly offering you 15% off all stock wheels and the depackaged bar and stem for the month of June. Just use the code HANDLAID2020 at the checkout. That's HANDLAID, or one word, followed by the number 2020. Downtime Live is back this week, so at 8 p.m. BST on Wednesday the 10th of June, you can head to youtube.com/downtime mountain bike podcast and get involved with my chat with Joe Breeden from the Polygon United Ride Team. You can ask your questions in advance on my social media or during the live broadcast in the chat. Just head to youtube.com/downtime mountain bike podcast now and catch up with all the past live episodes and set yourself a reminder for this week. Merchandise is back too. I've got a brand new web store with all new t-shirts in men's and women's fit. They're 100% organic and manufactured using renewable energy, and they ship pretty much worldwide. I've even managed to make them cheaper than they were before. The material feels super soft. They're really nice fit. So if you want to represent and help the podcast at the same time, then head to downtimepodcast.com/shop now to check them out. They've been pretty popular so far, so thanks to everyone who's already bought one. If you're not yet subscribed to the podcast, then you really should. It's free, it's super simple to do, and it means you'll never miss an episode. Just head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe and click the button for whatever platform is best for you. Apple and Spotify seem to be the favourites, so maybe one of those will work for you too. This week's episode is also supported by WTB, and this week I'm joined by one of their founders, Mark Slate, along with their product marketing manager, Clayton Wangwickler, to talk all things saddles. The saddle is a component that we all have and that many of us either take for granted or endure the discomfort that it brings us. But there's a lot that goes into making a good saddle, and no reason why we shouldn't all be on a saddle that's comfortable for us. We sat down to talk about how saddles have progressed since mountain biking began, how a saddle is designed, prototyped, manufactured and tested, and how you can go about finding the right saddle for you and making sure that it's set up properly on the bike. It's also worth mentioning that if you're based in North America, then WTB are currently offering 10% off saddles sold using their FitRight system throughout June. Just head to WTB.com to check them out. All right, without further ado, here's Mark and Clayton. All right, Mark Slate and Clayton Wangwickler, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Let's go over to you, Mark, first. How's things with you?
Going good. Beautiful day in California here. Up in my property, looking out at a beautiful blue sky.
Very nice. And what about you, Clayton?
I'm doing well. I'm up here in Bellingham, Washington, and we also have clear skies, which is a little bit more of a rarity for where I live. But yeah, all is well.
So you guys are a bit spread out as a company then?
Yeah, we have I'd say about a quarter of our workforce is U.S. workforce is working remotely on a normal basis. But right now, obviously, with COVID going on, about 95% of our staff are working from home.
Yeah. And how's that panning out? Are you finding that okay?
Yeah, it's working out really well. A lot more meetings, obviously, to stay connected. And even the little things, a lot more video meetings. When we normally have meetings, they're normally audio, but we've been videoing it just to kind of see each other's faces. And yeah, but everything is working out well.
Excellent. Good stuff. Well, Mark, let's start with you and we'll get a little bit of background on you guys. So just tell us a little bit about your background and what it is that you do at WTB these days.
All right. Well, with WTB since the get-go, founded in 1982, and I've grown up in Marin County, used to ride motorcycles and got to bicycles from motorcycles. So what I do is develop parts. And in the early days of WTB, it was ride it and break it. And it's a little more sophisticated now, but it is kind of gets back to that. You know, the idea is like, well, what really happens in real use? Lab tests are great, but real world is where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah. And that, when you say the early days of WTB, that was the early days of mountain biking as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I got started before mountain bikes were known as mountain bikes. So yeah. Yep. And in Marin County, where I'm from, you know, there was a lot of people that were riding and developing, you know, what we call them was cruisers or clunkers. And they were just old Schwinn's and Coulson's and old paperboy bikes, so-called fat tire bikes with 26 inch tires. And just, you know, if you could pedal them up the mountain, you were doing really well.
Nice. Yeah. Things have changed a bit. Clayton, what about you? What's your background and what brings you to WTB?
Yeah, definitely. I left pharmaceutical school to go ride my bike across the country because I wanted to ride bikes rather than make medicine, make pills. And so rode my bike across the country, realized I wanted to write about it. And so I started working for mountain bike magazines. I actually worked for Mountain Bike Action Magazine for a couple of years before I started at WTB. And since then, I was the PR person for WTB. And then this year, that has evolved into being the product marketing manager, so that I am now the in-between, the middleman between the product team and the marketing team here at WTB. So I'm involved from the start when we're thinking about what products we're going to create, and then working with the product team to actually make those products come to life, and then transferring all of that onto the marketing side where we're, you know, creating packaging and artwork and putting together launches and working with media and doing all that. So I'm kind of the one who has my hands in it from start to finish.
Yeah. Enough to keep you busy by the sounds of it.
Yeah. Super busy, especially right now.
Yeah, I bet. And so you rode all the way across the United States?
Yeah. Started in Bar Harbor, Maine, and then spent a few months and rode all the way to Oceanside, California. So dipped wow. toes in the Atlantic and then dipped them in the Pacific another 4,500 miles later.
Amazing. Were you self-sufficient, or how are you doing it?
Yeah, we were camping the whole time. My buddy and I, who I met in Peru and did a bunch of adventures when we were living down there, we got together afterwards and decided we wanted to ride our bikes across the country with nothing more than our hammocks and sleeping bags. So we did get one hotel in Utah when we got stuck in a blizzard and got a foot of snow on us. We got one hotel room in Utah, but aside from that, yeah, we rode our bikes and slept in hammocks the whole time.
Impressive. And are you missing the pharmaceutical world?
No, not at all. My friends are just finishing up school from that. So I think back, I'm like, wow, all this time I've been riding bikes and working in the bike, writing about bikes and working in the bike industry and loving it. They've been in school this whole time. Ooh.
Yeah. You made the right choice. Fair play. So. Good stuff. Well, we're here to talk about the saddle, effectively, which I think a lot of people will assume is a very straightforward component and often doesn't get thought about that much on a bike, maybe, but also can be the source of quite a lot of pain and frustration, certainly on longer rides for a lot of people. So we're going to get into that and find out more about the saddles and how they work and how you guys have approached it. But Mark, can you give us a bit of history on saddles from your perspective? I guess kind of, yeah, effectively 30 odd years of mountain biking. What were saddles like back then?
You know, to start with, when we were putting together bikes out of whatever was available, there were so-called touring saddles and, you know, a little more plush, but they were high-end saddles. We were selecting all the high-end parts we could find from road racing or touring, or sometimes we had to use so-called cruiser parts, thumb shifters and the like. But the saddles that we were looking for were the best we could find. There were some people using Brook saddles, and at that time the B72 was a favorite. That's a really nice looking saddle and fairly comfortable. Once you break it in, it needs to conform to you. You know, leather saddle takes time. And yeah, the saddles go way back. I mean, saddles for bicycles, you know, some producers have been doing it for 100 or more years. Long time.
Yeah. What were they made of in those early days of mountain biking?
Pretty much what we were using was the same as what we do now, which is a plastic, either nylon or polypropylene base or shell, and, you know, steel rails at that point, although titanium is a favorite. And, you know, foam padding with covers. So, you know, just not a lot different. I mean, they're certainly more sophisticated now. And they, saddles, you know, use, of course, carbon fiber rails sometimes and carbon fiber in the base material or fully carbon fiber bases, which really don't flex much at all. But some people like that. And so they're, you know, there's a variety, but there's not a lot of change, I would think, since what we started with.
Yeah, I guess in my head, I see these images of like old saddles with like a coil spring on the back of them, like the I guess the classic sort of Brooks saddle look. But I guess maybe that was not something that mountain biking really adopted. Just maybe clunkers and stuff were using them a bit, or not really.
Yeah, yeah. They, you know, there are some nice looking Brooks saddles out there. And again, you know, if it fit you, and that takes time because they're hard leather and tough to begin with, and you gotta kind of break them in. I remember beating on them with a beer bottle and, you know, just trying to get them to conform somewhat before you put more time on them. But yeah, they were the de rigueur thing at that point.
Yeah, yeah. And at what point did you start developing saddles yourself with WTB?
You know, back in the early days of WTB, we did some work for a big company, starts with S, and we had an opportunity to make a saddle. And so we did some saddle making out of wood and had a variety of different actually just a couple that we evolved to that were models that we were shaping and bolting on or screwing onto a seat post so we could ride them and, you know, making small changes as we rode. The idea of a wood saddle, of course, you know, it's like there's no flex there, but you get some time on them and you certainly can find out where the shape doesn't exactly fit you right. So, that was interesting and fun. That goes back to 1985, 89, somewhere in there, in that period of time.
Yeah. Yeah. So the wooden was just purely for a shape test. It wouldn't,
right.
Really do much riding on it, I guess.
You know, I have ridden on rock hard saddles for hours, you know, later on made out of hard nylon. You know, I've spent like over 5 hours on a nylon saddle. And certainly at that point, you're about done. But, you know, it's again, the idea is like, wow, you really get a good idea about where you want to make changes to shape. And for me, the idea that shape is the paramount thing, the thing to look at to begin with most of all is what I think is important.
Yeah. I was going to ask like, what are the key elements of a saddle in the modern era? Like, what are the different parts that make it up and what do they contribute to the overall performance and comfort?
Right. Well, you certainly want some flex, right? So you get a little bit out of the rail, and titanium rails, of course, are going to flex a little bit more. Carbon rails flex hardly at all. And bases are, can be built to tuned really to flex in a variety of ways, you know, so you can do a lot with what you're doing with the base. For foam, there's different densities of foam that you can select, and you know, how much thickness is there is a big deal. I think for people that don't ride bikes much, the idea is like you want a saddle that's got some degree of padding, right? Some depth of padding, and they do the thumb test people and get the idea that it's like, wow, that just that's not going to be comfortable. But any of us that ride for a long time realize that heavily, deeply padded saddles are not the way to go. They just don't feel good after, oh, maybe an hour. It's like, oh, this doesn't feel right anymore. So you need to get that shape right, and you need to have the padding really only as deep as you, you know, feel comfortable. Different people have different ideas about that for sure, but I don't like a lot of depth of padding on saddles I have. Again, shape is the deal I'm looking for. I want to make sure that the shape fits me well, and I can tell right away, you know, pretty much that I'm going to like the saddle or not. You certainly want to put some hours on it, but within 100 yards, I have a pretty good idea whether I like it or not.
Yeah. So how do you go about developing saddle then? Where would you start from?
You know, at this point, with all the saddles that we've done, a lot of times what I do is I take a saddle that has already been made. It's a standard that we have, and maybe something we're selling, maybe not yet. Maybe something that we've just got a temporary mold going for. But you take the cover off and shape the foam. And the way I do that is a grinder that doesn't have any guards on it, which you got to be really careful with. But, you know, you can take off a lot of material really quick. Some of the newer foams are kind of really gluey, sticky, and they don't grind as well. But after you get the shape kind of, faceted to a degree, and then you take some heavy coarse sandpaper, and you can really get the shape really how you like it. And that is certainly my preferred way to go about it. These days there's 3D drawing that you're looking at it and you're going, does that look right? And you turn it in the light and you try and get an idea of what it'll be like. I always like to get a temporary foam mold going, so we know, because it's just theoretical until you do that. But yeah, the shaping in actuality, so you can ride test it, is good. I've shaped the foam, and then what I do is just take a plastic bag and put it on there with electrical tape, so I don't stick to the foam, and then I can slide around on it and get a feel for it. A lot of times, the saddles that I'm shaping, they end up not having enough depth of padding because you can only take it away, right? So you're starting with something that may not have a lot of padding to begin with and working on a shape that's different. And you may end up going to the production guys, the tool makers, and go, okay, this is the shape I want, but I want this depth. And so raise it up from, okay, maybe it's 6 millimeters of padding depth, raise it up to say 10 or 12. And that's the way I get after it.
Yeah. So their work from that mule saddle effectively to they then kind of work backwards and create CAD models of that saddle so that they can go and produce it.
That is, yeah. If you're giving them a hold in your hand model, right, then they scan it and they have really high powered, high priced tools to scan and get the shape exactly right. And then they can put it input into CAD and from there they are going to make a tool. Anyway, I like to start with the shape, and then you create the base from the shape, so the base is the more expensive part with tooling, and it's very complicated tooling. There's slides that, can retract. So after you injection molding is the method. So after you inject the plastic into this mold, after it's all buttoned up tight and slid together, so there's no gaps, then, you inject the mold or inject the material and then slide it apart so you can, get the shell, the base out. And then after that, you do the foam part of the tooling. And that is usually the way that I've seen it done, mostly is with something that looks like a waffle iron. It's a pour mold. You pour the foam in there and then you cook it. Basically, you just compress it and cook it. And then you've got this pad shape. There are other ways to put those two pieces together. Vacuum formed is, a newer high tech way that is a little bit different than that, but, essentially it's the same. There's two different, components, right, to the saddle plastic parts. And then you fit a rail, you fit the rail, and usually that's kind of spring loaded into the base. You flex the base in such a way that you can fit the rail first, the tail end two pieces fit into the sockets in the base, and then you have to flex it so you can get the nose piece to fit, and that's how those two pieces go together, the base and the rail.
Yeah, and then you've got a cover that goes over the top of the foam,
right. Yeah, cover and all the graphics and markings, which is something I don't get that involved in. We have seen a lot of advancement in that for sure over the years. And there's some pretty beautiful saddles out there.
Yeah, for sure. So what sort of level of investment are we talking then? Like, how long would it take to make a tool for one of these saddles? And I guess it's the base element, the plastic element that takes the longest. And what, like, roughly are we talking hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of dollars of tooling?
It depends on I guess who you are and what you pay. So I probably shouldn't specify that. But the idea that, you know, if you're paying, and we have, if you're paying as much as $30,000 for molded parts, you're paying too much. And right. And we have paid that. So, you know, we're trying to do the best we can. And we have some good people to work with. So we get a break, and that helps, but it's expensive and you're committed. Once you make that shell, that's the piece that really you can't change. You can change the foam, and that's what I'm doing mostly these days. And that's in 3D. I'm looking at it and going, okay, that didn't feel right. So I want to change it. And you know, I'm looking at the various curves and places that I want to add or take away material and make it those changes. So you can give a tool maker a file that they can make an updated foam mold with.
Okay. Let's talk about a couple of the things that you see, I guess, talked about in saddle language. A lot of saddles will have cutouts in them. What's the thinking behind that, and how do you feel about cutouts and saddles?
You know, there's relief that goes down the middle of the saddle that I think helps. Certainly some people more than others, but there's nerves that you're sitting on, right? Our bodies aren't made to sit on that part so much. So you got to have a little bit of relief there. The idea that there's windows through those saddles, sometimes, you know, literally, you know, you can see through it, and that can create problems with the shell that maybe can flex and not the way that you'd like. So you have to, you know, take that into account and try and, you know, shore that up to a degree, which kind of, in my way of thinking, goes against what it's supposed to be doing. I mean, you're looking for it to flex more there, but if it flexes too much, that's a problem. It ends up caving in, and you end up, you know, running into the nose socket piece. And so there's some detail and tuning that needs to go on with shells. And my idea anyway on the window through ones is that people sometimes believe that that's the way, and maybe it helps. I'm not such a great believer, but as is often said with saddles, different people like different things, and you can't guess what anybody's going to like best.
Yeah, always a tricky one. Personal preference comes into it a lot, doesn't it?
Yes.
One of the things that certainly when I was younger, like, everyone wanted was to have a gel saddle, mm-hmm. and that doesn't seem to be as big a thing now. What are your thoughts on gel inserts?
Yeah, there's a gel, and then there's softer types of foam that you can put in there. I think with gel, it's so compressible that it kind of gets back to that, what do you really want that saddle for? And I think for some people, say that just are, you know, to the store and back, or riding with their kids, and they feel like, yeah, they do again the thumb test, and they feel like, that feels like I'm going to like that. And so, you know, that degree of compression is maybe suitable for those people and works better. I've not liked gel saddles too much myself.
Okay. And then you mentioned the rails earlier, and like you said, they come in different materials, often on the same saddle. So steel, carbon, titanium, they're obviously going to have a weight impact. Is that the main driver to choose one over the other, or how much impact do they have on comfort? Like, how would you advise people to look at that? Is it you buy what you can afford because it's always going to be better as you go up, or is there a bit more nuance to it?
Yeah, you know, certainly there's different degrees of flex that you get out of different materials. But some of that, I mean, think about where you're positioning your saddle fore aft on your seat post clamp, right? It's that's going to have some effect on it. So you may be, for me, I tend to run my saddles way forward on the adjustment, meaning that the clamps pretty far towards the back of the rail. And so then the nose is flexing down more, and that can be good, but, cause sometimes I'm sitting far up there if I'm trying to climb something that's really challenging, but, yeah, it depends on a lot of factors. I mean, you got people at different weights and, different uses. So, for me, the idea is, it seems to be mostly the weight is the sales attribute, right? That's certainly different flex, and carbon rail saddles flex hardly at all. You know, the rail part flexes not much. So that, but they're usually the lightest and known as the highest end. So that may be the choice that people want to gravitate to.
And the flex on carbon rail saddles, we oftentimes will do a softer base to kind of meet in the middle ground, so you have the stiffer rails with a softer base, so it allows more flex, so you can get as much flex. A lot of people have actually found that the carbon saddles are more comfortable than their titanium or steel saddles, simply because there's more flex in the base. Not all the saddles; some saddles use the same base between the titanium and carbon, but that's also a factor. And then there's also durability as well. I mean, steel rails are usually preferred by, you know, bike packers, for example, because steel will, first of all, flex the most out of those. So it can be maybe more forgiving and more comfortable on long days and long rides without having to use really thick padding that would pinch their saddle bones. And then also in those situations, if a saddle were to break or if there were to be any sort of issues with saddle rails, steel will bend, whereas titanium will generally want to snap, or carbon will as well. So there's different durability issues with them and durability strengths with them that people focus on.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. So if you're buying a saddle with carbon rails, it's not necessarily just the rails that are a different material. There might be other things changed.
Definitely. And as Mark said earlier, I mean, base can oftentimes be the biggest factor in how comfortable a saddle is, how much it flexes, how much all of that. I mean, it can be, even though it's hidden between under a bunch of padding and it's not as flashy and exciting as the rails, it can oftentimes be one of the things that are most contributes to how comfortable a saddle will be. We'll oftentimes run through the same saddle shape right now. Saddles that we're testing, we're doing three different base essentially flexiness, or I don't know what the proper word would be there, to see what's most comfortable.
Okay. So you do, yeah, you test a lot of different versions of effectively the same kind of shape and foam to get to where you think is the right place.
Definitely.
Yeah. At the end of the day, that is definitely the best. At the end of the day, it's like, well, ride test it. And we, over the course of the history of WTB, we have junked a lot of expensive tooling if it hasn't been right. So that is part of it. You need to, get on it and figure out if you hit it or you didn't. And, we aren't trying to, you know, provide the best for people. It's more important than just staying in business. It's what we want to do.
Yeah, I was going to ask a bit about the testing side of things. Obviously, you've got like the ride testing, the actual, I guess, the comfort of the product. You've got durability, which I don't know, yeah, whether you do that in a lab somehow or whether that's ride testing as well. How do you go about it? Because obviously, like you've mentioned, everyone is different. Yeah, do you have to get the saddles out to a lot of different people? How does it work?
So it's a two part, and maybe Mark can take over the first part talking about testing it to develop it. And then I come in when it's testing to like figure out if it's the best thing to go to market with. So yeah, Mark, yeah. If you want to tackle the first part.
Sure. Yeah. There's a lot of industrial type tests or, you know, industry tests that the saddle has to pass, you know, the amount of, weight that gets put on it and how durable it is. So there is a lot of that. There's a lot of standards for that, not necessary really to get into it, but that is something that happens at a supplier, mostly because it's really expensive stuff to do. You can find independent testing, and sometimes you want to do that, but for saddles, we rely on our supplier producer, and they do a great job with that.
Yeah. And then once the the tooling is made and we have actual sample saddles. We'll say we'll get 20 of them, and then we disperse them out to testers that we've been using for some for years, decades, a lot of them internal employees here at WTB, but also quite a few external testers. And then we just ask them to log and track their miles on them and determine comfort, durability, flex, all sorts of factors. Then the important thing on saddles that we always try and point out is similar to what I just said, in the sense that there are a lot of different factors that go into total comfort. There's not just when somebody tests something, we don't want them to come back and just go like, it's all right. Yeah, this is a good saddle. It's like, well, what do you like about it? What worked well? What didn't? Because we can independently tune the shell, the base. We can make it slightly more flexible or stiffer. The shape, we can bring in the edges just a little bit, or we can make it longer or shorter, or padding isn't just swapping out padding. We can use the same shape of the padding, but we can make it 2 millimeters shallower or deeper, or all of these kind of fine tuning little things. And when we do, we also try and test with a variety of riders. So we use athletes, we use the everyday rider. Like I said, we use employees, we use male testers, female testers. And yeah, just feedback and go from there. Hopefully we hit the nail on the head correctly the first time, but that's not always the case. And sometimes we got to go back and bite the bullet and change the tooling, but we're willing to do that because we want to make the best product.
But with a, you know, like we said, everyone's different and you've got a wide variety of people testing saddles. Are you ever in a position where you get kind of contradictory feedback, and how do you deal with that?
Definitely, especially in the sense that some saddle shapes just don't work for some people. So sometimes somebody will test out a saddle and they just go, oh no, I can't ride this thing. And it's like, well, it's hard to determine. Is that because the saddle actually isn't a good saddle, or does it just not work for this person? Do they typically ride a wider saddle or a narrower saddle or something along those lines? So it's hard to determine that. And you kind of, oftentimes how I do that is ask people what they typically ride. Like, oh, I typically ride the Silverado, the WTB Silverado. It's like, ooh, then maybe you shouldn't be testing this saddle. Because if you love the Silverado, then just shape-wise, you're not going to like this saddle. Or somebody goes, oh, I typically ride the WTB Volt, and that's where I found the most comfort. It's like, okay, this is a similar shape. This has a similar rise coming off the back of the saddle, similar thickness of padding. If you like the Volt, you should hopefully like this and can help us fine tune it.
So for people then that they're not often in a position to go and try a load of different saddles, and every saddle you buy is a decent chunk of cash, so you kind of want to get it right, and it's not always easy to find the right one. You guys have put quite a lot of work into that and developed a pretty interesting system to help do it, right?
Yeah, definitely. We understand that, you know, we have all figured out what saddle is best for us, and it's a make or break experience. I mean, a lot of people think that just saddles are uncomfortable and that's just how it goes. But if your saddle is hurting you and you're uncomfortable on your saddle, you're simply on the wrong saddle. And so, yeah, for a lot of people that can be difficult to go, wow, well, a saddle is 40 to 125 to, if I'm going to buy carbon, a $250 saddle, I can't just try out a lot of them. And so what we've done is developed a system to where people can narrow down the saddle that would most likely fit them by simply measuring their wrist. And I know that sounds crazy. We were a bit skeptical at first as well, but we had a previous saddle fit system that was like many other systems on the market, where you sit on a gel pad and then you sit up and look at where the imprints are and determine sit bone width. And while it worked, we were oftentimes estimating exactly where the center of those sit bones were. And there's also the factor of you had to have the tool. People had to go into a bike shop and go in there and have somebody kind of analyzing them in a somewhat private area, publicly in a bike shop. And it was just kind of an invasive method. So we wanted to figure out a way that was less invasive, could be done from anywhere, and was accessible by anybody in the world, and was free. And so with those guidelines, we looked into all the different things we can do and tried out, you know, sitting on pizza boxes was one of them. My favorite one that we did was sitting on bread. So we did testing of, you know, sitting on a 2-inch slab of Texas toast, essentially, and then sitting down and seeing where your sit bones were. And then our European office was like, no, you do not sit on bread. That is not okay. And we're like, okay, back to square one. And so we have this kind of, he's kind of the company chiropractor is Dr. Colin Phipps. And one of our employees was speaking with him and he was like, well, there's different correlations within the body. There's, you know, wingspan is generally the same as somebody's height. And in that same line, there's the width of somebody's wrist is typically this can be correlated to the width of somebody's sit bones. So we worked with him to develop a formula of how we can figure out exactly and accurately determine somebody's sit bone width based on their wrist. And to be honest, when he told us this at first, some of us were very unsure of whether this would actually work. And in the beginning, we actually put a test together to figure out, like, to kind of prove it wrong. If I'm going to be honest, like, there's no way this works. All right, let's test it. Let's try it out. And so we had him initially do a case study of 150 people of his clients that came through. And it was very accurate. Within 95%, it was accurate. We're like, oh, okay. So we got to start taking note of this. So we all started measuring people's wrists at events and seeing how it tied to the saddle that they were currently on and found the most comfort on. And again, it was accurate. So yeah, we started doing it and tested thousands of people. And in the end, we found that it would actually work. So we can correlate somebody's sit bone width, determine somebody's sit bone width based on their wrist width. And from there, we can allow people to figure out what shape would be best for them, depending on their riding position, or riding style, how long they ride their bike. And so now we have an online tool where somebody from anywhere can go and just log on to it. You don't even have to log on, actually. Just access the page, plug in your numbers, and it'll give you a list of what saddles would most likely fit you. But even then, we realized that's only the first step of the process. So getting to what you talked about, it's very difficult for people to be able to ride many different saddles and figure out what's best for them. So we have our test ride kit where an individual can go to a bike shop and all 18 of our saddles are offered as a test ride kit where you can go in, if the bike shop has it, which many retailers do, go in, provide some sort of ID or something like that, and then some collateral, and then leave with the saddle and go try it out. Some shops will let you do it for an afternoon, some a week even. So yeah, go try it out and go, okay, this test says that I would be best on the Silverado medium. So start with that and be like, oh, okay, that was good, but I think I could go a little bit wider and maybe thicker padding. So you can go try out the Bolt 150 the next day. So yeah, that is a way where customers can try out many saddles before committing to one. And so that when they finally commit to a saddle, it is the ideal saddle for them.
Yeah, I must admit, I was skeptical as well. Sat at my desk measuring my wrist a couple of months back. But yeah, it recommended a medium Silverado to me. And it's, I have to be honest, it's the first time I've ever put a new saddle on a bike and it's not caused issues in the first couple of rides. Like, I didn't even think about it. So there's got to be something in it, I think.
There you go. The proof is in the pudding.
Yeah. No, I was surprised. Yeah. Normally the first couple of rides on a new saddle, I'll feel it. And then I'll eventually maybe toughen up that area or whatever and get used to it. But I think what you guys are saying is you shouldn't really have to go through that.
No, you shouldn't have to go through that as well at all. And as you know from doing, going through the system yourself, it isn't just the width, the wrist measurement, but it's also, as you saw, it discusses what padding thickness would be best for you, what shape would maybe be best for you. And those are oftentimes things that people don't take into account as well. They go into a shop and it's like, okay, sit on this tool. Okay, this sit bone width works for you. So then they just go in and they just get one of those saddles. But there's a lot of other factors that play into it. And the FitRide app also allows you to figure out those.
Let's talk a bit about men's versus women's saddles, because that's an area where certainly a lot of women's specific bikes will have women's specific saddles. But I know quite a few guys that ride your women's saddles and found them really comfortable. Talk us through your thoughts on on that?
Yeah, definitely. So there are certain features that when we designed a saddle, let's take our Coda and the Diva, for example. Those are both women's, we don't call them women specific, they're more women's focused, because what happened with those is we went into it before we started testing or developing, asking female riders like, hey, what would you like out of a saddle? What areas do you feel pressure? What areas what do you look for in a saddle? And then we test that. I mean, we develop it and then we put it out there to test. But when we do, we send them out to male and female riders, whether it's a women's specific saddle or not, we send it out to women and men. And when we do, a lot of times we get feedback of, oh, I love this saddle and I don't know why, but it just works for me, you know? And a lot of times that comes from men and that comes from women. And so I think it just goes to show that there are certain things that we can strive for when developing a women's focused saddle, but in the end, just people find different comfort in different saddles. So a lot of times the Coda is a perfect example of, the Coda came out as a women's focused saddle, but I'd say half the men at the WTB office run WTB Codas. So I think there is certainly something to designing towards what women would like, but that doesn't mean there's necessarily specific design cues that make a women's specific saddle. And maybe Mark can comment on that further, and he has additional input on that, I'm sure.
To begin with, the Diva was a saddle that I wanted to design just to fit me. I didn't have the idea that it was a woman's saddle, but I wanted a shorter and slightly wider saddle. And so after getting that one done, I felt like, yeah, I hit that pretty good for me, you know, and then other people seemed to like it and women really liked it. And so it became the idea that, okay, that's more of a woman's saddle. And the conventional thought over time has been that women want or need shorter and wider saddles. That's, you know, that doesn't hold true for all, for sure. I know some women that like, you know, road racing saddles that a lot of men like that are longer and narrower. But the idea that, you know, that depends on the person. And maybe women with wider sit bones are going to be more comfortable on a wider saddle. And the idea that the length, maybe they feel like it looks more right for them or something, that's something to that. But the idea that you need to ride to decide is really the thing that at the end of the day, that's what we'd hope to have people do. That's the best way to know.
Yeah. So people shouldn't be put off then if they use the tool and they get recommended a saddle that they perceive as being for a different gender.
I think not. You know, I think the idea that, you know, if you can try it, that's great. You know, if you can spend some time on it and get an idea whether you like it or not, that's good. We try and provide a breadth of offerings that can fit in a variety of people. We're just trying to do the best we can to get people comfortable and happy on saddles.
Good stuff. Yeah. So following on from that, then you can get the perfect saddle for you, I guess, but you can then set it up in a position that makes it uncomfortable. Is that fair to say?
Certainly. I mean, yeah, for me, the idea is like, if you have a quarter inch difference fore aft, that's a big difference. If you have a degree of tilt nose up or nose down, that's a big difference. And it's funny because I spend a considerable amount of time in Taiwan. I get different bikes there. And when I go there, I get on the bikes and go, oh, wow, yeah, that saddle position is different. And I know it's not much, but you can feel it. And so the idea that you want to pay close attention to that is key. You know, certain people like to sit way far forward. Some like to sit further back. And the idea that how much tilt you like and what bike you're on is certainly part of it, right? If you got a drop bar bike, you're going to be leaning forward more. You're going to be carrying your weight in a different part of your anatomy down there. And you're going to probably want a different saddle. You know, if you're sitting more upright you're probably going to want a wider saddle with more padding.
And are there any kind of, I don't know, rules or processes to help people get set up? Because there's, like you say, there's saddle fore and aft, there's the tip of the saddle, whether you're tipping it forwards or backwards. And also you've got the saddle height compared to the pedals as well, I guess. Is there any kind of guidance that, that could help people?
I think the main thing there is, I think that first of all, nothing can replace getting a professional saddle fit. I've been riding bikes for decades now, and I got my first professional fit last year, and it drastically changed my riding experience. Not just in comfort and power, which are the obvious things that you think about, but how my body wears. Like, I had lower back issues that I didn't realize stemmed from the fact that I was running my saddle height a whole inch higher than they suggested. A whole inch, because I really liked extending my leg all the way. It just felt comfortable to me, but it was bad for me. And so I've gone and lowered my saddle an inch, which felt so incredibly awkward at first. Like, I felt like I couldn't ride a bike. But my lower back issues are nearly gone from it. So, you know, there's that. First of all, I don't want to tell people that they can just fit from home and be good, because I don't think anything replaces a professional saddle fit. But there are certainly different little tools that people can use and little tricks to, like, somewhat dial in their bike fit. For example, running a plumb bob off your knee, your knee should always be directly above the spindle of the pedal. And so that can adjust fore and aft, and or at least create a good starting place to determine where you should be fore and aft, where the saddle should be mounted. But from there, you can factor in, you know, you don't want to be too far over the bar. You don't want to be too bent over, or some people don't like to. Some people like to be more upright, and that'll change depending on the reach of the bike. So there are all kinds of individual factors like that. A lot of people who like to live in, or who live in areas with really steep climbs, like, for example, where I live here in Bellingham, Washington, you'll sometimes see saddles pointed a little bit down so that when people are climbing, they're not sliding off the back of the saddle. There's little things like that. You'll also see pro cross country racers and such with their saddle nose down so that they have more to push off and allow more power transfer. I think it's Nino Cole, or what's Cole Havey's first name? Cole Havey. He's the guy who infamously hit the nose of his saddle is like 2 inches down, which is a bit extreme to me, but it just goes to show that, like, there are different saddle preferences of how people can set things up. But yeah, I think the main thing that people should be going for is the knee plumbed out with the pedal, center of the pedal, and then roughly 20 to 30% bend of the knee is, and if you ask professionals, that can go all the way up to 35% bend. Some people say, you know, professional racers can do down to 18%, I think it is. I'm not a professional on this, but I think that if your knee bend is around 20 to 30 degrees, you're probably in a good starting point to figure out what's most comfortable for you.
Okay. So that's with your foot at the bottom of the pedal stroke.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure there's going to be some fit person who's going to be very angry I gave that number. Maybe, but that's a, that's a good rough estimate. And again, I would like to tell people, go get a professional fit. You will thank yourself. Your body will thank you.
So do saddles have a lifetime then, in a similar way to helmets do? Does the foam degrade over time or not?
I think that depending on how much use it gets, and certainly whether it's seeing a lot of UV radiation, right? That, I mean, that'll break down anything over time. So that can be a factor, but, the foams that we have these days, they're pretty resilient. They last a pretty long time. Saddle bases, depending on what they're made of or how they're, built, constructed, where the thicknesses are, they can break down, cave in over some time. But, you know, if it comes down to, if it's not bothering you, it's not a problem, is the way I look at it. I mean, maybe you're hurting yourself and you don't know it, but I find that unlikely. I think that, if you're uncomfortable, you're going to know it. So I would say, you know, if the saddle is not feeling right to you, then look for change somehow, some way.
I would say working quite a bit of events, we oftentimes have people coming up and showing off their WTB saddle. And I've had this thing for 15 years and I love it. It's my favorite saddle. And oftentimes, you know, those saddles at that point, you know, they look worn, but they're still trucking along after 15 years. And so I think that unlike helmets, which naturally degrade, and people suggest you replace your helmet every, I believe it's 3 to 5 years. I guess it depends greatly on the helmet, but I don't think a saddle is really going to degrade in that sense. And I also think you're probably going to fall and tear up your saddle and scuff it up and all that far before you're going to actually structurally degrade.
Yeah. What about storage? Because I've seen some people like storing their bikes kind of upside down with the saddle and the handlebars on the floor. Is that prolonged weight through the saddle a bad thing for them, or will they just bounce back?
I would think that over time it's going to compromise that resiliency, you know, it seems like, but maybe not, you know. Again, you know, if it's not a problem for them, if they ride their bike and they haven't changed the way it fits them, then it's probably not an issue, but I wouldn't do that myself.
I also wouldn't suggest, for two other reasons too. And one of them, it's just, you're going to scuff up your saddle. So whether it's going to actually damage it or not, you're probably going to be scuffing up your saddles and handlebars. But the other issue is totally unrelated to saddles, is oftentimes bikes nowadays, most of them are running hydraulic brakes. And so it's really only an issue if you actuate the brakes while it's upside down. But if you have any air bubbles in your line, they will then go up to the caliper, which is then at the top now, which can make it provide unpredictable braking. Air bubbles could get trapped. So yeah, I'd suggest against it for other reasons that aren't just the saddle as well.
All right. Good advice. You guys have got quite a few of the top athletes in the sport now running WTB saddles, haven't you? I think with the Athens are using them, Pivot Racing.
And yeah, we have a whole crew of world traveling athletes that are, you know, that are on our saddles, and some run in the complete setup and some just saddles.
What do those guys and girls get involved much in kind of testing or feedback or any input into design? How do you work with them?
Definitely in testing. In design, there are certain saddles, like we, a few years ago, we had the Hightail, which was, we worked with the Pivot team to create a saddle that would clear the rear tire under full compression on the Phoenix downhill bike. So there are certain instances like that where we've worked with teams and athletes to develop a saddle specific for something. But typically, otherwise, the athletes don't come into the picture until it's testing time. Because even though they're athletes and they're incredible, their butts are just like any other person's butt. So we don't really have to design a saddle specifically for them unless their bike requires it. So, but we do use them a lot for testing. I'd say about... on saddle testing, I'd say anywhere from a third to a half of the people who test the saddles in the end are our athletes of all disciplines. But yeah, I mean, definitely when you have that sort of talent and that sort of, when you have people that have that much time on their bike, because time is the main thing with saddle testing, that, yeah, we definitely use them as a resource.
Yeah, I guess especially the cross country and the enduro teams that are just putting in huge rides day in, day out.
Oh, definitely. I mean, they'll put in, that's what they do for work. So they'll put in more miles on their bike in, you know, a day than a lot of us will be able to squeeze in a week. So
yeah, for sure. Cool. Good stuff. Well, it's been super interesting finding out a bit more about something that I think all of us just take for granted and assume is simple. And it's good to hear that we don't need to suffer and that there are ways to find saddles that are comfortable. So yeah, thanks for taking us through it. If people want to find out a bit more about you guys and check out the FitRite system, where can they do that?
Yeah, I tell people to head over to WTB.com. On there, we have a whole backstory about the company and where we're at and what we've done. And also regarding FitRite, we have the whole FitRite page that runs people through the system, whereas we also have videos. Rachel Atherton has put together a video that's on our website walking people through every step of it. And we've also included a whole backstory page where we just talk about how we've gotten to where we are with the FitRight system and why it came about, and yeah, the proof behind it working.
Awesome. Good stuff. Well, yeah, thanks a lot for your time. And yeah, hopefully people can get stuck into that. If they want to go test some saddles, is it fairly easy for them to find out which dealers have got that available?
Yeah, definitely. I would suggest they just call. That's the easiest way. Just call and check, hey, do you have the WTB? It's called the Test Ride Kit. And if they don't, you should tell them to contact their WTB salesperson and try and convince the bike shop to get one. They're even on sale right now for the entire month of June. So tell them that. They'll be even more likely to get one.
Perfect. Good stuff. Well, thanks a lot. Super enjoyable to chat with you guys, and enjoy the rest of your week.
That was great. Right. Thank you, Chris.
You do the same. Thank you.
All right, that's it for this episode with Mark and Clayton. I hope you've enjoyed listening. A massive thanks to We Are One Composites and WTB for supporting this episode. Don't forget to head over to wearonecomposites.com and check out their great range of wheels and their depackage bar and stem. If you're tempted, then you can make the most of being a downtime listener by using the code HANDLAID2020 at the checkout for 15% off all stock items. That's HANDLAID, HANDLAID, followed by the number 2020, all lowercase at the checkout. If you're based in North America, then WTB have got 10% off all saddles sold using the FitRight system during June. Just head over to WTB.com and check them out. All the links are in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. Don't forget to check out all our lovely new merch over at downtimepodcast.com/shop, where you can pick yourself up some new threads and help support the podcast at the same time. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and please keep on spreading the word. That can be by telling your friends or by sharing our episodes in whatever way works best for you. The more people that listen, the easier it gets for me to keep this thing going. So spreading the word really helps make sure that this podcast stays on air. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon. But until then, look after each other. And if it's okay to do so, then get out and ride.